Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. I'm Dr. J, and I'll be your guide to a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. Speaking today with Richard Wagner. He's the author, most recently, of Designs on Space, which is an introduction to many of the space missions that have been in the hopper at NASA, some of which are no longer in the hopper and some of which are still. And before that, The Case for Mars with Zubrin, who was the founder of the Space Society. And before that, he was the editor of Ad Astra, which is the National Space Society's magazine. Welcome, Dr. Wagner.
Hey, good afternoon.
I am very interested in this. I used to belong to the NSS read the Ad Astra magazine and have joined the Mars Society and been a big space enthusiast. And Designs on Space is a little bit more down to earth, as it were. It's a little bit more about what's currently on the books. The International Space Station is one of the current projects. I want to have you just review for us, what's the current state of space policy? It's in a bit of a flux now with the new administration.
Well, yeah, it's in a bit of a flux because Golden is, or I should say Administrator Daniel Golden.
Of NASA.
Of NASA is still at the helm at NASA. We are expecting that the Bush administration we'll probably pick a new head for NASA. So I would say before Bush space policy gets really writ large, they'll have to have their own administrator over at NASA. So things are in a state of flux because of the political change.
Is Dan Golden associated with Democrats? I mean, is he a big spender or something?
No, he's not associated with Democrats. He actually came in under a Republican administration under Bush Sr.
Mm-hmm.
And is now, he is the longest serving NASA administrator. So he's not necessarily tied to any distinct political party. He's more tied to introducing cheaper, faster, better, supposedly the new way of doing things at NASA. Because NASA for the past, under the Clinton administration, 7 years in a row, their budget dropped each year.
So is Bush more favorable towards funding NASA, or are the Republicans in a more favorable mood? Or?
It's hard to say. I really can't say because I've seen no good rumors on it. I've seen no good reports on it. There are rumors floating about that George Jr. will try and match his father in announcing a Mars program sometime this summer, but that, as I said, is really rumor at the moment. And I think, as is the case in the space community, lots of times rumors are actually expressed wishful thinking.
Now, one of the things about the Bush administration that's been clear throughout their foreign policy is a marked isolationist or America should go it alone kind of policy, and a great deal of suspicion, kind of neo-Cold War suspicion of Russia and China. Has that reflected itself in our International Space Station? Maybe you should just tell us about what the International Space Station is.
Well, the International Space Station is the culmination of a program that was started under Ronald Reagan, who actually declared that the United States would put a space station up in orbit way back in, I think it was 1984, 1986, somewhere back there. NASA has finally got bits and pieces of it up. It's not complete yet. It'll be a couple more years before it is complete. But it's being undertaken as a joint project with a senior partner in the guise of Russia, plus more than a dozen European countries. So it is it's a massive bit of international collaboration, in large part because it's costing a massive amount of money. And when it comes to large space projects of this sort generally, there's a tendency to declare that they'll have to be done collaboratively with other nations simply because the costs demand that. Of course, one of the downsides of that is that collaboration does tend to drive the cost of things up because you've simply got more management and more management problems that can arise, and people disagree or people misunderstand one another. And the space station has not been immune to that.
Mm-hmm. And the difficulties with Russia are particularly political and financial, that Russia has a deteriorating space program.
Mm-hmm.
And we've had a lot of disagreements with them over the financing of the ISS.
Yeah, I mean, Russia has, their economy has been in free fall the past couple of years, and their space agency has been short of cash, and that has led to some delays in them supplying materials for the station, elements for the station. As it stands now, they are Russian collaboration is a critical part of the space station program. Their Soyuz capsules are the escape capsules, as it were, for the station. They supplied the first component that went up. So in years past, there were calls for the United States to simply drop Russia out of the picture, but it never came to pass because they were just too tightly ingrained in the program. They were playing too important a role. And that'll continue. They have a lot of launches on their rockets that will take supplies up, and the United States doesn't have any way to really replace the launches that Russia would be undertaking for us. So,
The most recent wrinkle in this is Dennis Tito going up with the Russians to the station.
Yes.
He paid $20 million, an American mm-hmm. businessman, and the NASA was not open to the idea of selling a seat to a civilian, and it was quite hostile to him while he was up there. Spread a lot of disinformation about him.
Very hostile. One of NASA's less finer moments, in my opinion. He originally bought a ticket to Mir. Mir, of course, was put into the ocean. Mir was the Russian space station that had been up for years.
We have to say that shows his devotion to space, that he would be willing to go up to a death trap like Mir.
Well, you mentioned disinformation. I mean, in part, Mir, you have to put it in perspective. Mir was a workhorse. It was a space station that was up there for I believe, more than a decade. And as it got older, you know, you live in a house, your house gets a little bit rickety. It got a little bit rickety, but I really think that the notion of it as being a death trap obviously resulted from some incidents that happened up there where for a couple months it seemed as though things were thoroughly out of control. But, I mean, the bottom line is that the Russians flew the thing, kept it up there, kept it going far longer than the United States has ever done when it comes to space stations. And here it was as the United States was commencing to put up this brand new, nice, shiny space station. So
we leaned on them pretty heavy to bring down Mir.
We leaned on them very heavily, and I'd say for good reason. When I mentioned before the launches that the Russians have to supply for the International Space Station, there was a serious question as to whether or not Russia could support Mir while fulfilling its responsibilities and requirements for the ISS. So if you're an ISS manager, there's very good reason to get the Russians to put Mir in the ocean to guarantee that their limited capabilities, financially limited capabilities, would be directed towards the ISS. And that, to me, was fair enough. It made sense. But we did lean on them. There's no doubt about it.
Speaking today with Richard Wagner, he's co-author of The Case for Mars and Design Zone Space, and a former editor of Ad Astra magazine, which is the national magazine of the National Space Society. Talking about the constituency, the political constituency for the space program, it seems that a lot of the steam that motivated us to get to the moon has evaporated in the last couple decades. And some of the enthusiasts for Mars exploration, most notably the new Mars Society, which the Case for Mars set the ground for the founding of, hope that Mars, that the exploration, colonization, even terraforming of Mars, might be the kind of vision that gets us back into space. Do you see those kinds of political, social energies being mobilized?
It's hard to say. I mean, the first decade of the 21st century is way different from the decade of the 1960s. I think the American public's attention span for things that might be deemed amazing is a lot shorter than it was 40 years ago, because we are talking 40 years ago. It's a shocking thought. But undoubtedly, there are a lot of folks out there who are, you'd call them the space-interested or the space-aware community, who will be lobbying for greater federal dollars to be spent on space exploration, both human and robotic. I think the main difference between now and back in the 60s is back in the 60s, back in the Apollo days, space was really viewed by people as a government program. The difference nowadays is that governments are not the sole players in the space arena. Dennis Tito is a prime example. He was a private citizen who contracted with a private corporation, MirCorp, to get a ride to Mir. There are a number of private companies that are trying to, or that at least have plans, to do private lunar exploration, or the better term might be exploitation. So while something as big as human Mars exploration definitely will take some government funds, of that I'm sure, there's also another layer to it, which is the ability of the private sector, or even private individuals for that matter, to actually mount exploratory activities of their own, which was unheard of 40 years ago.
The case for Mars and in the Mars Society both argue that practical technologies that could be envisioned in the next 10 years or so could get us to Mars for about $20 billion.
Mm-hmm.
And given maybe post-tax cut, that's inconceivable that we'd be able to spend $20 billion. But we had, $1.3 trillion here that we just gave back to the American people that we could have pulled out $20 billion to go to Mars with.
Yeah, I mean, the thing about space exploration in general, especially when it's government-funded, is that, yeah, the technologies are important and the rocket fuel is important and your spacecraft is important, but what's really important is money. That's the bottom line.
Mm-hmm.
Burning dollar bills is the basic rocket fuel. If you're doing a program that's federally funded, that's the bottom line is that it's not technology that's going to get you anywhere. It's going to be politics. And that's why the Mars Society, along with the National Space Society and other outfits, believe strongly in the necessity of trying to raise public awareness of space exploration in general and the benefits of space exploration specifically.
Now, one of the other political dynamics that can be used to mobilize folks is if we could make space exploration seem vital to our survival. And the spate of concern now about asteroids and asteroid impacts,
mm-hmm.
Has given a new impetus to tracking, to telemetry, to telescopes in space and so on. Can you tell us a little bit about what's NASA doing in that regard, and has that given a new burst and another leg for the space program to stand on?
Well, certainly. I mean, a couple of years back, the number of missions that popped up that were directed to comets and or asteroids all of a sudden just really took this little jump, in large part because there was this recognition of the dangers of asteroid impacts, and then there was the Hollywoodization of the subject. And certainly, getting Hollywood to spend a couple $100 million destroying the planet is the best advertising for a space program anybody could ask for. Currently, there are a number of missions. One is in flight, Stardust, which is headed off for a comet rendezvous and aims to bring back some samples of the of the material coming out of the coma of a comet. There are a number of tracking programs, but they're funded. They're not funded as much as one would probably hope they would be. Most of the recent estimates I've seen, you know, still say it'll be a decade or so until we have a really good notion of possible impactors that might be floating around in our general vicinity.
The Britons seem to be ahead of us in that regard. They have a member of parliament, or maybe it's the House of Lords, who is an astronomer concerned about this, and they've committed a good chunk of change.
Yeah, there was a recent near-Earth object report that came out a couple months ago, and it raised people's eyebrows, and it raised awareness. But I think it's fair to say that the same thing happened in the United States, except a couple years prior to that, in some hearings that were held in Congress and, you know, up on the Hill, and everybody's eyebrows shot up, and there was a squirt of money, perhaps added to the NASA budget. But our cultural short-term memory is pretty short.
I'm speaking today with Richard Wagner. He's the co-author of The Case for Mars, which helped to found the Mars Society. He's former editor of the Ad Astra magazine, which was the national magazine of the National Space Society, and most recently the author and co-author of Designs on Space. Now, another concern that people have that might be related to space is ways to make things in space, to certain kinds of production that might occur in space that we aren't able to. You mentioned the exploitation of space for mining and things like that. But is there any industrial application that has come on the scene, or that people imagine coming on the scene, that might be a motivation for space colonization?
Well, I'm given the horrors that California is having with electricity, I've sort of been waiting for someone to start talking about space-based solar power once again. Space-based solar power is a very intriguing idea, and it's pretty straightforward. Imagine planet Earth. You have your solar panel up on top of your house. It gives you electricity. A cloud comes along and socks you in for a week. There goes your electricity. Space-based solar power just imagines putting that solar panel, actually a much larger one, out in space, where the sunshine is free and it lasts 24 hours a day. It would collect sunlight, and the power would actually be beamed back to receivers on Earth in the guise of microwaves, and then turned into electricity, and the basis of your power grid is power from space. It's a great idea. When it was first introduced back in the 70s, it was an immensely expensive idea. Times have changed a bit, but not all that much, because in recent studies of space-based solar power, it is still it's still a good idea, because it seems so simple, but it's still really expensive, in large part because of launch costs to get material to orbit. But if there was a big commercial benefit to be gained in orbit, certainly space-based solar power would be the lead, or one of the leads. I don't want to say the lead. The other aspect of commercialization that's popped up, again, it's in the guise of Dennis Tito. It's tourism. There is, over the past couple of years, there's been this slow awareness that, well, maybe there might not be all these materials available, or there might not be materials that are readily available, say helium-3 from the moon or some such thing. There might not be that readily available, but what could be readily available is simple entertainment, taking people someplace they haven't been before. And Tito is an example of that. There was a guy who wanted to pay $20 million to essentially take a trip where, you know, most folks can't go. So space tourism has become, over the past couple of years, sort of a bit of a buzz within the space community. And I have a feeling it will continue to be so, because there are a number of companies popping up looking to fulfill, individuals' dreams of spaceflight. One of them being a company that's going to be running zero-G rides in an airplane down, and I believe they'll be based out of Huntsville. It's available if you want to spend a couple seconds in zero-G.
Given the likelihood of nausea in zero-G, I can't imagine that that's going to be a very popular tourist attraction.
Well, actually, you know, it's interesting. I read something, an interview with a fellow who had been up, it's a problem, but he sort of, essentially he said, you know, after the first three or four, you get used to the environment. So it's stomach lurching, but, you know, after the first three or four lurches, you get won over by the experience, and the experience is supposed to be really pretty wild.
Hmm. So where do you think things are going? We've got this fiscally conservative but pro-military-industrial, pro-space Star Wars, and relatively positive towards the space program Bush administration. I guess during the presidential campaign, the three major candidates were approached about their attitudes towards Mars by the Mars Society, and Nader refused to entertain the idea.
Yeah.
Gore refused to give a statement, and Bush was the only one who was moderately positive on it. So, well, do you think that there is a possibility here, or is it just an illusory because of their unwillingness to fund anything?
Well, yeah, I mean, it comes back to the bottom line being dollars. And I don't see the present administration being antagonistic towards it. The Clinton administration was not necessarily antagonistic toward it. It didn't pay that much attention to space policy, and if NASA's budget dropped by a percentage or two each year, it didn't care that much. I have a feeling that most administrations will be that way, unless they can see some exceedingly positive benefit coming out of an aggressive space exploration program. I think they'll let NASA continue as it has, which is, you know, an interesting department within the federal government that does cool things and doesn't use up too much money, and just sort of let it stay that way. Which is why groups like the Mars Society and others think that one of the things they have to do is to raise public awareness and raise political awareness of the benefits that might result from a more aggressive program of exploration.
Some wag said that the only three things that you need for space exploration is propulsion, propulsion, and propulsion. And could it be that even given our current stasis in political support for space program and stasis in financial support, that the advances, the technological advances in propulsion and materials and in manufacturing and so on, might allow us to have cheaper and cheaper and more feasible options within those constraints?
Yeah, if right now, I think if you ask anybody, and if you ask them, well, what's the main problem with getting to orbit, people will say costs too much to get a pound of metal to orbit, costs too much to get a pound of human flesh to orbit, it just costs too much. Now, NASA had a program going that was the X-33 program, Venture Star, which was a collaboration between NASA and one of the major aerospace contractors that was supposed to bring down the cost of orbit by a factor of 10. And if that had happened, that would be a great thing. It was a program to develop what's called a single-stage-to-orbit vehicle. Single stage to orbit means that you do not drop anything off your rocket as you get to orbit. Nowadays, when you go to orbit, you have a first stage, second stage, third stage, etc. And as you go up, as they empty themselves of fuel, they drop away, thereby lightening your load. Single stage to orbit, you would just go up in the you would come down in the rocket ship that took you up. It has proven to be exceedingly difficult technically to do that. And NASA has essentially given up on that program. It's now got another program in place to again look at launch technologies with an eye to cutting costs for getting mass to orbit. But it'll probably be looking at multi-stage rockets again. Nowhere on the horizon is there anybody waving their hands, really, I believe, saying, I have a definite technical fix to the problem of getting to orbit, of getting there cheaply. Maybe 50 years down the road or beyond that, but in near term, it's hard to say whether or not anybody will be able to do that. And that's the kind of thing that would be the technical kicker, if someone could really cut the cost to getting a pound to orbit.
Mm. Well, hopefully we'll have both some progress technically and politically that'll make all that possible. I really want to thank you for joining us today. What are you working on now? You're a policy, general science policy analyst. Are you going in some new policy direction?
No, I'm still writing about space, and I'm working a lot with the Morris Society, because we have a lot of projects coming together, more habitats, more analog research. In other things, it's just more science writing, having nothing to do with space, actually having to do with the origin of life, which is just an interesting topic.
Cool. Well, we look forward to that, too.
Yeah.
I've been speaking today with Richard Wagner. Richard Wagner is the author of The Case for Mars with Robert Zubrin, which helped to lay the groundwork for the Mars Society, which is a national lobby for exploration and colonization of Mars. He's the co-author of Designs on Space, which is a beautifully illustrated introduction to many of the different space programs that have been on the books at NASA and will be on the books for the coming years if the finances hold out. And he's the former editor of Ad Astra magazine, which is the national magazine of the National Space Society, the largest lobby for space exploration. Thanks for joining us today, Richard.
Thanks very much.
You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS FM at the University of Connecticut in Storrs. If you want to learn more about democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts about this show with me, Dr. J, email me at jhughes, that's J-H-U-G-H-E-S, at changesurfer.com. You can also check out past and future shows, archived in streaming MP3, and myriad relevant links at the website, www.changesurfer.com.